Hello and welcome to IndieInterviews.com, a weekly radio show where we interview independent musicians to get their perspective on their music, their history, and the world around their art. On this show, your host Garrison Reed sits down with John Roderick of the Long Winters. John discusses touring's impact, writing about relationships, and his thoughts on life's ultimatums.
What is that about? Like, who says? I mean, Bob Dylan made three records in 1965, but Axl Rose has been making the same record for 14 years. And everything in between, right? I mean,
The Long Winter's latest release, Ultimatum, showcases the band's recording variety. The record features rich layers of piano, strings, and vocals. Here's a snippet of Commander Thinks Aloud from the band's recent EP, Ultimatum. With Chris Walla and Ken Stringfellow, the Long Winters have been working on a future full-length, the first produced solely by Roderick.
What did the European hike teach you as an artist and a writer?
Wow. Well, as a writer, I kept a journal as I walked along, and so it just got me a lot of practice, actually, you know, pen or pencil on paper. Which is something that has a lot to do with learning how to write, you know, just practice, like, just writing, as they say. As a songwriter, I've thought about that before. I can't really say whether it helped or hindered or had no effect. I'm sure, you know, it has played into my whole Well, you know, in a bigger sense, like completing that walk was really instrumental in me making the first Long Winters record. But not in a creative sense. In the sense of like, before I took that walk, I had never really seen any of my creative projects all the way through to completion. You know. I mean, all through my 20s, I was always waking up in the morning and saying, I'm going to write a play. I'm going to write a book about a play that I'm going to write. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to do a musical play, and I'm going to write a book about it, and do a series of, like, watercolors.
Yeah.
And then I'd start on those things, you know, I'd start to write the treatment, or I'd go down to the store and get a sketchbook, and I never saw all that stuff all the way through. And, you know, if you do that for several years and just have a pile of uncompleted things, that starts to get frustrating. It starts to be a further impediment to getting stuff done, you know. Mm-hmm. You start to work on something new and you're like, oh, I'm never going to finish this. Look at all this other stuff I never finished. And in that sense, you know, making it all the way to Istanbul from Amsterdam, in spite of all the tens of thousands of reasons why I should have not continued, you know, why I should have stopped, because it was in some ways a totally stupid thing to do. But after I was there, I realized, you know, I finally actually finished one of these pie in the sky projects.
Mm-hmm.
And had this galvanizing effect when I got back, where all of a sudden, like, finishing these projects, in comparison, didn't seem very hard anymore, you know? Like, oh, I mean, it took me 5.5 months to walk to Istanbul. Like, I can't work for 2 weeks on this thing and get it done?
Yeah.
You know, of course I can. And so ever since then, it's been a lot easier for me to creative projects, and every time you complete one, then it adds to your list of things that you've actually completed, and it has the same sort of, it has the rather the opposite effect of not getting things done. You know, it becomes a snowball effect.
In the interview with Believer, you talked about the size of the indie audience. Mm-hmm. In print, it's kind of hard to tell your satisfaction or dissatisfaction with that. Where are you, really?
The rise of the indie audience?
Yes.
Well, I'm very happy about it in the sense that when I was 21 years old and had a band, the majority of the rock audience that I could see, that was visible to me, was interested in music that I just was not capable of making. You know, there was this huge global audience for grunge rock music where there was a lot of screaming and a lot of, you know, boogie-woogie chugalin guitar parts and a lot of, you know, leather pants, and I just couldn't make that kind of music, and so whatever kind of geeky music I and my friends were making had, as far as I could tell, no audience at all. Now, I know there, in looking back, I think there was an audience. It was just, I didn't know how to find them. But now, the fact that there's a large and growing audience for, you know, for music that is more complicated and more, in some respects, more awkward, I think is a wonderful thing. The downside of it is that, and I think I touched on this in the Believer interview, that, you know, the indie audience has an even greater predisposition to be sort of clicky, and also the sensitivity and the awkwardness of the music appeals to, you know, the sensitive and awkward sides of people. But that there's a tendency, I think, to have that be a self-reinforcing feedback loop, so that a person says, you know, I'm sensitive and awkward, and I like this music that appeals to my sensitive and awkward side, and so I'm going to follow that down some kind of rabbit hole where I don't even think of myself in any other terms. You know, I'm leaving behind the part of me that's actually confident or actually competent, and I'm going to become this person that just thinks of himself or herself as totally sensitive and awkward. And I think that's destructive. I think it's destructive to the listener. I think it's destructive to the bands too. You know, mm-hmm. Because sure, everybody feels that way sometimes. But you also have to get up in the morning and, you know, pay your phone bill and put gas in your car, and those things, like your sensitivity and awkwardness, don't improve that process at all, you know.
Student, why do you dream of me when you dream of your acre of trees? It was agreed I came to burn the, it's all I ever claim to do. A plowman I'll never grow into. My arms miss you, my hands miss you. The stars sing, I've got their song in my head.
What led to the addition of the two acoustic tracks on the EP?
You know, Barsuk, as a record label, is really focused on songwriting. You know, that's the motivator behind Josh Rosenfeld, who owns the label. You know, he is not trying to sign bands that he thinks are cool or that he thinks are going to be cool next year. He's not trying to sign bands that are going to make him a ton of money. Like, his whole thing, and all the way back to when he worked in a record store, was, are the songs good, you know? And it's a unique, it's a, unique or peculiar business model for a label, because I think most labels are, you know, they put out a few records by guys that they like, and then they try desperately to find records that are going to sell a lot of copies. And so Josh is always pushing us, all the people on his label, to really emphasize the songwriting. And one of the ways that he feels like it, that really stands out the best, is in those kind of stripped-down environments. I mean, that's how I originally got signed to Barsook. Josh had come to see my rock band, and he had been, you know, kind of wishy-washy about it. Like, or he, not even wishy-washy, he was like, yeah, too many distortion boxes. But then he came to see me play an acoustic show, and after the show was just like, I get it. I get the songs. I get the whole, I get it, you know? And so he's always pushing to strip it down like that and just get up there on a stool with the guitar and show everybody how the songs are made and how, you know, so that there's nothing for people to get distracted by except focusing on this music. And he's really almost an evangelist about that. He's always talking about putting us on tour with each other, you know, like, okay, here's the deal. Vanderslice and Matthew Cause from Not a Surf and Ben Gibbard and you all in a van on tour together playing acoustic shows. What do you think? I'm like, yeah, I think it's a great idea. It'll never happen, but, you know,
yeah.
Keep dreaming.
The EP that was just released is described as an epic studio experiment.
Uh-huh.
Could you explain that comment?
Well, right before we went into the studio to record, we sort of lost half the band. We had done a lot of touring behind Pretend to Fall, and we went to Europe and did a month of touring over there, and it had started to take its toll on some of our band members. I mean, you know, part of the, one of the big problems about being in a band is that, you know, when you have a band and you're around town here, you know, wherever it is you live, and you're playing shows, you know, twice a month or something at the local bar, it's easy for everybody involved to feel like, yeah, man, this is what I want to do. Let's take it to the next level, you know? But when you are living out of a van and in motel rooms and it's the middle of winter and you're somewhere in Hamburg or whatever and staying in some rickety old place, although it sounds glamorous, after a while it becomes mundane, like everything that you do, and you start to notice some of the guys in your band are like, yeah, I really miss my Totina's microwave pizza and the other things about being at home that I enjoy. And it's no way to I'm not slagging my former bandmates off, nor am I slagging off any of the millions of guitar pop musicians who have decided they don't want to tour, because there are, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of them at least.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, it's one of the main reasons that bands break up after their first tour. So anyway, we had booked studio time. Our record had done really well. We had been on tour we'd been on tour for 2 years. We were excited about, like, yeah, we'll put out another record and we'll just do more and more of this. We'll go to Europe again and again. We'll tour all around America and it'll be awesome. Oh my God. And then I look over and, you know, half of my band are like, oh no. Is that really what's going to happen? We have to keep doing this? Oh. So, suffice to say, we showed up at the studio that first day with time booked and a lot of excitement about making a record. And there wasn't really a band. There was just me and Eric, the bass player. But at the time, Eric he was in another band or two. He was, you know, had a lot of other irons in the fire. So I said, well, I mean, I can cancel these sessions or I can just go in and make a record. It's not like I'm incapable of going in and playing all the different parts. So it became it became more and more of a studio experiment as it became more and more clear that some of that stuff was going to be very hard to ever play live or play accurately, you know, unless I had a band with like six keyboard players and a string quartet.
Yeah.
But I guess my attitude then was, who cares? I mean, what else am I going to do?
Yeah. How are you approaching these upcoming recordings, instrumentally and lyrically? And
well, I'm going to produce this record myself.
Wow.
And you know, I've co-produced the Long Winters records up till now, and I think at a certain point realized like I have a really clear picture of what I want to do, and you know, a part of me wants to work with every boy genius producer in Washington State or in the West Coast, of which there are, you know, some great artists here in the production field, mm-hmm. and I've worked with some really good ones. I've worked with the best, but I realized like I want to just do it myself now and not have to discuss it with anybody and just do it.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I'm a little bit out on the wire in that if it, you know, if the record sinks, or if it is hard to listen to, I guess is a better way of putting it. If the record is hard to listen to, there's not going to be anybody's fault but mine.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot of work. I mean, I'm as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm going to open my notebook and start trying to finish the lyrics for a few songs. And then later on this afternoon, I'm going to have the band come over, and we're going to run through some riffs I've been working on, you know, some song arrangements. And then when everybody goes home, I'm going to go back to working on lyrics. And through the whole process, I'm also trying to think like the producer and think, you know, what sound am I really going for here? And is this going to be, you know, is the acoustic guitar going to drive this song, or is it going to be driven by the electric guitar or by the piano or yeah. What?
Blue in the broad light of day, your claws are snagged on my face. Say it, I wish we were naked, and I wish that I could take it. When you turn on me, my arms miss you, my hands miss you. The stars sing, I've got their song in my head. I don't want my words twisted. I don't want you to listen too closely. Oh, wait for me impatiently, and I hope I can keep seeing you as long as you don't say you're falling in love.
One of my favorite parts about the Long Winters is the fact that the lyrics are really insightful to relationships. Not to pry, but have you had like a rough road, or are these relationships you've read about or heard about? Like in Nora, the exchanging hostages. That's just such a brilliant analogy, and it's something that I think so many people can, you know, empathize with.
Yeah, to empathize with that line, of course, you would have to have felt it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the reason that a line like that is useful or meaningful to people is that you suddenly are reminded of the feeling of it, and I think that would be pretty hard to write if you hadn't had relationships that evoked those feelings, you know? Like, I don't think you could evoke that feeling yourself if you hadn't felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, I have had relationships that have been very tumultuous, and it's, for a long time, it was confusing to me why that was. I would look around and see other people who seemed to have married their childhood sweetheart, or, you know, they would be in a relationship for 8 years, you know, and they're only 24 years old. You go, mm-hmm. How have you been in a relationship for 8 years? You guys met your sophomore year in high school? Oh, yeah, well, you know, we really get along well, and, you know, really, yeah. And it made no sense to me at all.
Yeah.
How that was possible, considering that they were living in the same world that I was living in, and every time I would, you know, become interested in a woman and see her from across the room and we would be magnetically drawn together, it was immediately like, I mean, tremendous sparks then bursting into fire, then spreading into a conflagration that burned up everything around it, and in the end, you know, a lot of sorrow and bitter recrimination, and then a few months later, you know, resignation and exhaustion, followed by grudging friendship,
yeah.
and you know, sort of wry, ironic, you know, paldom that in many cases persists to this day. But it's certainly not anybody's. The relationships that I've had are not represented in the larger culture of romantic literature and art,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't seem to be one where it's definitely not a model where romantic songwriters go, I'm gonna write a song about this guy and this girl who, you know, beat the shit out of each other emotionally, and then in the end, you know, kind of can barely tolerate to live in the same town. But that's been the deal with me, and I think most recently I've become maybe comfortable with that being the state of affairs, and have stopped fighting it so much. And that has actually introduced some amount of relaxation into my life, in the sense that it's not a fatalism, but it's a feeling that whatever it is I'm looking for, whatever it is people are looking for in me, there's going to be a lot of disappointment. And so when, knowing that going into it, you know, let's make the best of it.
Yeah.
Let's have fun for 6 months at least.
I belong to someone already gone. Hard to want, your heart to crumble up. I belong to someone gone before I was born. She was gone. She was gone before I was born. The last time we crossed, I held you under, wanting to feel you, wanting to breathe. And I thought you wanted to feel like breathing.
Do you have an ultimatum for yourself or for the Long Winters as an entity?
Well, you know, in my experience, having been friends with a lot of other musicians and bands who have gone on to do great things and bands that have perished and whose career has ended in disaster, I've really noticed that bands that have a tendency to draw lines in the sand for themselves, like, are shooting themselves in the foot, you know, bands that say, we will never do this, or we are going to be at this point by this date, or, you know, any kind of thing like that. I think in certain cases, it can be really galvanizing, and if you're a young band and you say, we're going to take over the world by March of 2004,
mm-hmm.
It can be a motivator, but for somebody my age that's been you know, playing music as long as I have, I've really had to realize that the only plan you can make is I'm going to keep my eyes open and my ears open, and when opportunities come along, I'm going to judge them in the moment and decide, you know, based on the strength of that opportunity, like, is it a good thing for me? Okay, then yes, let's do it.
Mm-hmm. So there's a certain amount of irony to the title and to the song?
The title of the song is that, you know, I've been delivered over the years a lot of ultimatums from other people. Like, okay, you know, if we're going to stay in this relationship, then you have to do X, Y, and Z. And I've always been baffled and confused by that mentality. Like, why are you delivering an ultimatum to me? Like, are we in this relationship or not? If we are, then we are going down life's pathway together, but we're not. Like, from whence comes the idea that, all right, we've been in this relationship 6 months, so now if we're going to continue from this point forward, you have to make the following concessions, or, you know, like, coming not as a natural progression between two people, but as sort of an expression of one person's mentality about what a relationship is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, here's your ultimatum. And, you know, life is full of that, where it's basically an expression of, you know, there are a lot of people for whom the uncertainty of life is too much to bear, and so they try and control that uncertainty by issuing ultimatums to their friends and the people around them, you know. And it doesn't actually help them control life any better. It just helps them alienate their friends or, you know, or bully their friends. So looking at or just feeling that feeling in the smallest possible framework, which is the relationship between two people, in most cases, the way that people act to each other in relationships can be, you know, it's usually that's a metaphor for how people act in the larger world with each other, you know. And so there are all kinds of ultimatums that come down to the Long Winters from the music industry and from the, you know, from the audience in general. I mean, they're just the reception of this EP, where, you know, every single person that has talked to me about it or written about it has started out by saying, "What took you so long? You know, your record came out in 2006, and you know, so what have you been doing? Why did it take you 2 years to release this EP?" As if, you know, as if we were, like that there's some systemic, you know, set of expectations that the Long Winters have deviated from, and so there's all this confusion and surprise on the part of people. It's like, what is that about? Like, who says? I mean, Bob Dylan made 3 records in 1965, but Axl Rose has been making the same record for 14 years. And everything in between, right? I mean, how long was it between those 2 Wren's records? Like 10 years. So, yeah, just the general feeling that ultimatums are not useful.
Yeah. And it's like laundry, you know, once you do X, Y, and Z, like you were saying, there's another X, Y, and Z, and then there's another X, Y, and Z.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's a perfect description of it, in the sense that I've never met an ultimatum when there wasn't another ultimatum looming right over the hill.
Thanks for listening to IndieInterviews.com, a weekly podcast where we interview independent musicians. More information about our guests today, The Long Winters, can be found on their website, thelongwinters.com. Music samples on the show are from their 2005 EP, Ultimatum. For more information on this release and the upcoming full length, visit barsook.com. For information, including a transcription to this interview, please visit IndieInterviews.com. For feedback on this podcast and the materials used in its production, send your thoughts to IndieInterviews@IndieInterviews.com. Thanks again, and see you next week.
But it didn't hear. My new friends have messages.